Welcome all sports fans. On this podcast,
no sport is left behind.
I'm Justin Williams.
I'm Cabrera Duran, and this is our brother from Down Under,
me, Wallace Bruce.
We are the Pro Sports Podcasters,
filling you in on the latest news from the world of sports.
In this episode, we talk a whole lot of football as me, Justin, and I speak about the NFL, CFL, and even XFL. But we also splash in a little bit of golf because this was the Players Championship weekend, and we did the recording Sunday morning, but as of right now, I know that Justin Thomas finished with a fantastic final round to win the trophy. And let's get right into it. Who proposed the CFL-XFL crossover?
So from my understanding, how this worked is the CFL is in financial difficulties, and they have been for a while, evidently, yeah, with what's happened.
That's been a struggling league for quite some time.
Evidently, yeah. And for a while, if you may recall, they had a deal with the NFL.
Yeah, they did the occasional preseason game. I saw the two preseason games held at the, now it's the Rogers Center or the Sky Dome. There was the preseason game that we touched on with Kelly Butler in one of our previous episodes that happened in Winnipeg. That was a
poop show.
Yeah, basically. Right. But yeah, they've been trying to do that. And then since that didn't really go over, they've been doing the whole NFL in Europe since then.
Right. And NFL isn't alone in that. CFL has done it too, called the CFL 2.0. Far less known and far less impactful. So basically, from my understanding, what has happened is there used to be a time when the CFL was struggling worse than what it is now, despite the fact COVID definitely put them on financial fumes. At one point in the early 90s, Vince McMahon had approached CFL and said, "Hey, I want to buy you." And they said, "Hey, no." Then Vince McMahon went to the NFL, or vice versa. He went to one of them, and NFL just kind of laughed him out of the room. They're like, "Absolutely not."
Yeah.
So then him and Donald Trump started the XFL. I was only hesitant because I couldn't remember if Trump was actually involved or he was just in talks, but somehow Trump had his hand in it.
Okay.
So the XFL started, which was two seasons ago, and got shut down after like four games because of COVID.
Oh, so okay. Well, so you're talking about the second version of the XFL.
Second version. Yeah, there was a first version as well, as some of you may be aware, that I think went by a different name.
No, it was XFL.
Still off XFL? Okay.
Yeah, it failed miserably as well.
Right. And then there was another league that happened for like a year, and I don't remember what that was. But that tried to compete with the NFL and did poorly. But moving forward, so there was that XFL, and now XFL revived, we'll call it. This was partnered with Vince McMahon, Donald Trump, whatever. That failed horribly and was sold to Dwayne The Rock Johnson for just over $25 million.
Okay.
I don't think The Rock even noticed that money missing. I think he forgot. And he like, the weird thing is, The Rock actually bought it alongside somebody else too. A woman who I am honestly forgetting her name right now. Yeah, Danny Garcia. That's it. Danny Garcia is part owner, which makes her the first ever woman to own a professional league.
Why do I recognize that name?
She's a bodybuilder.
Is she married to The Rock now? Yeah, she was. She was married to The Rock. That's why I know her.
Oh, she was married. Well, either way, they're in business together.
Yeah. I think they have a number of businesses together, actually.
Huh. I did not know that. Well, I mean, as long as they stay amicable, I suppose.
Yeah, married 1997, divorced 2008.
Oh, yeah, you are correct, yeah. And now they both remarried and they're both in business together.
Huh. So that makes sense that they just basically purchased another business.
Yeah.
And realistically, an entire league for $25 million is kind of a
joke.
That's like a drop in the pond, really, provided you can turn it into something. And so far, the XFL has not become something.
Correct. Moving forward, so they bought it for $25 million, which 12.5 mil each, assuming it was split 50-50. I don't know, but well, whatever. $25 million bought between two people who can afford it.
Yeah.
So now, from my understanding, the XFL has approached the CFL, and because The Rock is an alumni.
Correct.
He didn't actually play, but he was on the roster for the
Calgary Stampeders.
Thank you. Calgary Stampeders. He feels like he almost owes it to the CFL to help put him on the map again because they have kind of lost touch. with fame outside of the major cities, because, you know, people in Toronto don't care, like we have the Argos, people in Vancouver don't care, BC Lions, people in Montreal don't care, hence why those three teams tend to sign the bigger names, Johnny Manziel, Ricky Ray, BC Lions were in talk with, oh my God, what's his name, from Seattle. He retired and came back, and then, yeah, he retired and then went back to the Seattle Seahawks.
Marshawn Lynch.
Marshawn Lynch, thank you.
Don't forget to buckle up.
Don't forget to buckle up. Yes. Oh, my.
Nick Arbuckle, baby.
Yep, yep. Sorry. You took me off my words. I forgot about him. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Yeah.
Moving forward. So there are talks going on in the CFL to do an XFL crossover game with a hybrid potential. Now, this could mean two things. Because this is still so new in its infancy, they're not sure. From the various articles I've been reading, XFL does not want to impede on the NFL, for sure.
It can't.
Exactly. It knows it would get destroyed.
Yeah.
And in fact, the first season of the 2.0 happened hours after the Super Bowl had ended.
Yes.
So, and as we know, that didn't happen this year yet. But from my understanding, they want to do it just a little after the NFL and just before the CFL. Because between CFL and NFL, there's a few month gap there. So the XFL will be almost like a training ground. The XFL would bleed, if I'm not mistaken, ever so slightly into the CFL, potentially because of COVID with the situation. But in an ideal world, Kobe, we would have NFL, XFL season, then CFL season, a little bit of a break, and then back to the NFL. Okay, so it's football all year round, just like soccer, all year round, which is great, helps grow the game. Now, here is the concern. What rules would a hybrid game employ?
As it stands, there are no rules for the XFL right now.
It barely exists, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, they could just continue from where they left off, in which case the rules are in place, but they may change some of that too, because there were some sort of experimental rules involved that they thought they'd test out in the XFL that may eventually make its way to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's now got new ownership and it's got to basically rebuild again, they could kind of settle out some new rules or new structure to the actual thing, but I still expect it to be a four-down system.
It's weird you say that, because there was a little bit of talk and whispers and rumors that it would be a three-down system until the last quarter.
Really?
Yeah, that's one of the rumors I've heard.
That's interesting, because I know originally the XFL was sort of originally penned, the second version of it at least, was penned as a feeder league to the NFL. It was a way for, say, college players or guys who got unnoticed to mm-hmm. get noticed. They had a second shot, basically, to get noticed by the NFL and maybe make their way there. And it was also a place for NFL players who were maybe at the end of their careers but weren't quite done playing. Instead mm-hmm. of having to go to, a league in Europe or the CFL, they could drop into the XFL, remain close to home, and they'd have that opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was kind of like how it's penned. So if they were to go to a three-down system, that's a complete flip, because now you're really becoming a feeder league for the CFL in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do like the three-down system as far as entertainment goes.
It forces things to happen a lot quicker, kind of pushes the game a little bit.
And you can't get a sort of commanding lead, let's say a 2-touchdown lead, and then lean on the run to end the game. Like, you can't mm-hmm. do that in a 3-down system. So no game is essentially out of reach when you're playing with 3 downs.
Correct. Further, to kind of solidify that point even more, there was another part that we're thinking of that would have a, almost like how UFC does it, how there's, for title fights or for like main event cards, there's, yeah, sorry, 5-5-round fights. And in this case, they would actually alter it. So if it was like the equivalent of a Super Bowl or like a divisional championship, those games would be played with 4th downs as opposed to the 3.
That's so strange.
Right. So there's definitely implementing different rules everywhere. Again, it's just, they're in talks. Nothing's signed yet, but these are what I've been told from various reports I've been reading online.
I think the most interesting thing you mentioned is the possibility of CFL and XFL kind of rolling into each other.
Mm.
I think it would be cool. Like, the CFL would thrive if there were additional teams in the States.
Yes. Yes.
I think the CFL being a strictly Canadian construct mm-hmm. with Canadian teams, and some of which are in major markets that have much more attractive teams to watch.
Right.
That's where the failure comes in. That's why the CFL has been struggling for years now.
Mm-hmm.
It's because if you live in Toronto and you have a hierarchy of teams to watch, the Argonauts are way down that list. Or, sorry, the Argos now.
Correct.
But the Argonauts, to me,
yep,
are way down that list. You got, I mean, everything comes before them. Everything.
TFC does. And that's impressive.
That's right. Think of how young they are.
Yeah, 07. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're significantly above the CFL. I mean, there are times, not that long ago, when the Argos were in the Grey Cup game,
mm-hmm,
and won. And I didn't know they were in the Grey Cup game until like the week before. Because there wasn't even news about it.
Right.
It wasn't even news about it. It was just suddenly they found themselves in the Grey Cup game. So suddenly, the sports networks were like, whoa, wait a minute. We should probably say something. We're a Toronto sports network. Mm-hmm. Hey, by the way, in case you didn't know, our Toronto Argos are going to be playing for the Grey Cup next weekend. I'm like, what?
Right. The Toronto who?
You hear nothing about it. Like, we have so much available to us, at least in Toronto, that there isn't even airtime really available to the Argos.
We're kind of numb to it. Like, they won in 2017. And to be fair, like, it was a bit of a run because, you know, the Argos won, then the year after, and the same year too, TFC made it to the finals. The Toronto Marlies won the Calder Cup. Then TFC won the championship. Then the Raptors won. Like, the city of Toronto was kind of spoiled with championships. But most people forget that 2017, when the Argos won, they're just like, oh, what? Some people don't even know we have football here.
That's right. That's how small it's become, at least in this, mm-hmm, market. Now, it's the opposite when you go to, say, Alberta or you go to Saskatchewan.
Correct.
They love their teams.
Religiously.
Absolutely love their teams. But, I mean, you can have love for a team, but if there isn't really much for that team to play against, that sort of defeats the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why crossing over with the XFL and having additional teams to play, that makes it far more interesting.
I agree. So it's almost like every other North American game, from like hockey, basketball, baseball, soccer, whatever.
That's right. But I think the tough thing to cross there is that the Canadian market is very protective of the CFL. You can want to bring in sort of an American flair to it, but man, it's very difficult to do. They have a lot of things in place to protect the CFL from basically being bought out by foreign ownership.
I agree. 1,000%. We're very protective. We're like, we're the oldest. We're not going to change. And it's like, okay, hold on, BlackBerry. You're going to crumble unless you learn to adapt.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Right? And like, is your headquarters in Waterloo? Because we need to have a conversation. Now, this also brings me to my next point. Before, in 2019, do you remember 2019 when you can go to a restaurant mask-free and everything? What great times that was.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Oh, God. Moving forward. There was talks of having a maritime team. So one that represents New Brunswick, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, PEI, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And they had made way. CFL had placed where it was going to potentially be built down in Prince Edward Island, if I'm not mistaken. And they were going to open that team in 2021. Well,
COVID happened.
COVID happened. There's no 2020 season, so absolutely no revenue. And, I have heard not a peep from that. So I have relatives, as you know, in the East Coast. And yeah. I said, hey, you know, how do you feel about CFL no longer coming there as of now? And the only response I got was, hopefully the XFL will pick up where the CFL left off, in the sense that they would bring a team to the Maritime Province. And that's a thought I haven't thought of before. I never had that worry.
Yeah, but again, that's highly unlikely.
Very.
You cannot bring an American-owned, basically, team into a potential CFL market unless the CFL goes ahead and says, you know what, that's okay. But the problem with doing that is, as soon as they let one team in, you're going to have the NFL knocking.
Right. And if the NFL wants to knock, sure, let them knock. But here's the issue that – I shouldn't say issue. The point that my relatives were making. They said that, okay, if they do bring – a CFL team / XFL team, whatever you want to call it, a team there, it wouldn't happen in the first year, maybe not even the first 5 years, because there has to be that revenue stream. So let's assume after 5 years that there is that revenue, then there becomes a Maritime Province team. is there almost a need for it at that point if it's bringing in enough money? Or will it be like an idea that gets pushed aside because better opportunities like an NFL team comes knocking?
Well, people have tried to bring the NFL into Canada. It's never happened. They've badly wanted the NFL in Canada, and it just has not happened. So unless the CFL folds, unless they fold, or they sell the entire league with some sort of guarantees of certain teams remaining to the NFL, I don't see the NFL getting a franchise in Canada. I really don't. As much as it makes sense to have one here, there's just so many roadblocks to get over to get one here. And people with a lot of power, a lot of connections, and a lot of money have tried and not succeeded.
It's brutal from what I've been told. But
yeah, it's all to protect the CFL. That's all it's for. It's just to protect the CFL. Because the fear is, let's say you let an NFL franchise into Toronto. Well, that kills the Argos completely. I mean, they're practically dead already, but that would kill them completely. So now you have NFL to watch. Then you're going to have other markets that look at it like, wait a minute, if Toronto gets one, we kind of want one. And you've already mentioned them, right? Vancouver would want one. Montreal would want one, right? That means you got two more CFL franchises that would die. And if that's the case, then the remaining CFL franchises that people actually like, they're not going to have teams to play against, so the CFL dies. That's the domino effect.
Right.
So the only way to do it would be to literally sell the CFL, the entire league, to the NFL or to somebody with guarantees that certain market locations would remain as NFL franchises.
I agree.
If you were to say, okay, we'll sell you the CFL, but you have to have guarantees of an NFL franchise X number of years in Calgary, in Edmonton, in Regina, Saskatchewan, you got to have these teams exist. Otherwise, there's no deal. And it's got to be rock solid. I think that's the only way you do it. And then the NFL looks at it like, well, can we really make money in those locations? Right? Can we? And if they don't think they can, or they don't think they can make enough in the other locations where they actually want franchises to be, then they won't do it. So I don't know. I would love to see it. Trust me, I'm dying for an NFL franchise to be here. It kills me that every time I want to see an NFL football game, I have to go to the States to see it.
So they're saying for the CFL, this could be great financially because, all right, you partner with The Rock. And who doesn't love The Rock? Cool. So you have The Rock. And then if you say, okay, Kobe, we're going to sign you to play for the CFL. But however, you now have the option of playing in the XFL as well.
Oh, so you're looking at it. It's possible that teams could essentially share rosters, almost loan players like they do in soccer.
Exactly.
Right? So you could have two contracts, one that runs through the XFL season and then continues on the CFL season.
Yeah.
The only difficulty with that is because they run concurrently, if you get injured in the XFL,
yeah,
then you're essentially taking yourself out of the CFL season.
Correct. Now, also in theory, there could be like, hey, I play for the NFL, XFL, and CFL. So let's say you finish off your contract with the NFL, and you're like, you know what? I don't exactly feel like quitting just yet. Cool. Jump on the XFL train. You know what? I think I still have a few more months in me. Hop over the CFL train and be like, ah, you know what? I'm done. And I feel like that will happen to Tom Brady. I legitimately feel like he'll go in, win one more championship, call it quits, jump over to the XFL, win there, jump over to the CFL, win there, and be the first to retire with three rings back to back to back.
Nah, he won't do it.
Probably not, but let me live my fantasy.
it's a fantasy you can have for now. I don't see him ever leaving the NFL unless it's to retire.
If he becomes a Toronto Argonaut, I will be at every game hoping just to get a glimpse of him with his helmet off. That is all.
I'm dying to go to an NFL game, man. I was all planning to go to an NFL game last year. Then COVID happened. I'm like, no.
No.
It's brutal. No, you gotta be kidding me. Oh, man, I wish it was an NFL team in Canada.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at pro.sports.podcasters for the most current sports news. Now back to the show.
Before we get back to talking more football, Nia asked me a couple of questions about the Players' Championship that's happening right now as we record.
So, Kobe, where does the Players' Championship sit in terms of the golf hierarchy of tournaments?
That's actually a tricky question because, I mean, technically, it's not a major. So, it would be prudent of me, really, to put the four majors ahead of it. But for me personally, it's my second favorite event. And there are a lot of people that would consider it the unofficial fifth major. And if you see it as such, then it's definitely a little more popular than some of the others. And more importantly, it has the most stacked field of any tournament in golf.
Interesting. And the Players' Championship, it's hitting the crescendo stage, the final day of play. What can we expect as the tournament comes to a close?
This is actually a very special event. I mean, it's always a special event, but this Sunday is going to be sort of key in a discussion that's been going on for quite some time now about whether or not the game of golf is getting overpowered by not only the players, but the equipment, and even more importantly, the actual ball. Engineered advances in the equipment and the ball itself, and players taking on a more fit-oriented role as far as golf goes. I mean, golf used to be seen as the game that the old out-of-shape guys played, but now you look at the top golfers in the world, and the majority are prime examples of fitness. They are in phenomenal shape. And this Sunday, the final pairing has 47-year-old Lee Westwood, who is a veteran of the game and who plays it in a more traditional manner, paired up against Bryson DeChambeau, who has become the poster child for getting the most out of the technology that's available to him, transforming his body. I mean, during the COVID lockdown last year, he added 20 to 30 pounds of muscle to his body during the lockdown, came back after the lockdown looking like a different individual, and is now the longest hitter on tour. He just smashes the ball. He takes these ridiculous lines that no one even considered before because of how far he can hit it. And the two of them will be in the final pairing. So it's almost the old school versus new school who will come out on top. And in this case, old school actually has a two-shot advantage. Lee Westwood begins the day with a two-shot advantage over Bryson. And I like the fact that it shows you don't have to just concentrate on gaining more distance, more distance, more distance to win. It's the better golfer on the day will win out.
Right. Precision is still important in the game.
Correct.
Do you feel like the game is going to just adopt a lot of these innovations, or will there be moves to try and limit some of the, innovations that we're seeing in the game today?
Yeah, the one thing that gets brought up constantly is whether or not they should kind of nerf the golf ball. Okay, if they think that maybe the golf ball itself is the primary problem to this new generation of players hitting it further and further and further. And that maybe if they limited the capability of the golf ball, you'd have a more traditional game and things could roll from there. But I don't think that will happen, to be honest. I really don't think that's going to happen, because it would diminish everything that happened previous to that. And one of the beauties of golf is that the average person, someone like myself, can go to a course and play under the exact same conditions as a professional, with the exact same equipment and the exact same sort of limitations that are placed on everyone based on the course itself. If you then nerf the ball, you would essentially be forced to either go ahead and have a ball that's shorter off the tee and shorter overall in distance for everyone, and that could make the game unappealing to the average player. Or you'd have to have two balls, a ball that the professionals play and a ball that an amateur's play, and that takes away the purity of the game.
Right. I guess one of the changes that we saw in the last 4 or 5 years has been the introduction of golf to the Olympic schedule as a competition at the Olympic Games, both on the women's and men's side of things. Where would the Olympic tournament rank in terms of all the tournaments? You mentioned that the Players' Championship is your second favorite and is considered by some as a fifth major, but where does Olympic gold sit in that respect?
Yeah, that's a difficult one to determine, because, I mean, really, So you've got one Olympic event that's happened that's just passed. And that was the first of the return of golf to the Olympics. And the only people they really asked about, you know, they really questioned it about were the people who played in it and ultimately the people who won. So to them, it was a massive achievement, right? To be someone who's played golf all their life and as a professional and have a chance to represent their country and come away with a medal. It's massive to them. But to the players who are kind of outside looking in, whether they might make it to the Olympics, might not, I'm not honestly sure how important it may be to them. I think it's probably more important on the women's side than it is on the men's, because the women's side doesn't get nearly as much attention for their professional tour as the men's does. So if you're, let's say, somebody in the PGA Tour who's never won a major, but you've come close, probably winning a major would be huge for you. And the opportunity to win a medal for your country would probably be a very distant, you know, distant second, maybe distant third to even just doing well on the PGA Tour. Whereas on the LPGA Tour, on the women's side, winning a major would, again, probably be a massive thing. But I think winning a medal for your country would be just as big, because it may even garner more attention than winning a major.
Just staying with the women's game, the LPGA Tour is just about to kick off, if I'm not mistaken. Who are some players that you've identified that are due for a breakout this season, or who should we be watching on weekends this spring?
Yeah, so the LPGA Tour has had, what, they're in their third event now, right? So it's just gotten going. And, I mean, you have the consummate players on at the top of the rankings that are always doing well. But this particular year, I think there's an opportunity for some of the lesser knowns to really make a statement, because this also, again, being an Olympic year, they have another stage for which to shine on. And it's one that they'll have an opportunity to be in a smaller field. The Olympics is a 60-person field. And to represent your country in the LPGA, there are only a few countries that are really dominant in golf. And then there are quite a few countries represented, but they have far fewer players and they're not as high on the rankings, so they don't get noticed. So due to the Olympics, they have a chance to shine. They really have a chance to show out and demonstrate their skills. So I'm looking at some of the lesser known players from the not so dominant countries to step up. Germany has two very good players that will be in the Olympics. Sofia Popov, who made a statement last year, albeit it was a smaller field than normal, but she won the Women's British Open, and as an amateur, actually. But she'll be representing Germany for sure at the Olympics. Caroline Masson, she's the other German that you'll see there. She too has a great, fantastic game, but she gets overlooked, especially here. I mean, German players don't get much press on the Canadian and American market, but they should probably make a statement. Well, because it's hosted in Japan, there are a number of Japanese players that should show out. Currently, the way the qualification works is the top 15 players qualify, unless there are more than four players of one nation in the top 15, because you can have no more than four players represented. But as of right now, I believe, last I looked at the Rolex rankings, there are three Japanese players that would qualify. So they'd have an extra player as opposed to just the basic two. Everyone knows Nasa Hatoka. She's done very well on the LPGA Tour. But there are a couple others that, again, on home soil, they could really show out. So that's who I would really kind of pay attention to. Outside of the names everyone knows, the South Koreans, Se-Yung Kim, Jin-Yung Ko, the Americans, you have now Nelly Korda, Lexi Thompson, you know, people that are very recognizable. You'll probably only have one representative from New Zealand, but she's having a fantastic year, and that's Lydia Ko, is really on the bounce back. She'll be representing New Zealand. Look to her to maybe surprise everyone and win the gold. She's one of my picks to win the gold at the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, New Zealand, it's a small nation, but they punch above their weight in all sports. So it'd be good to see them do well in golf if Australia or Canada can't. Now, Cole, for us who are trying to improve our golf game, where can we catch some of your instructional videos?
So for those of you that aren't aware, I cover a lot of golf, both PGA, LPGA, my personal growth, because I'm really still a new player to the game, although a complete addict, on my Cobe Life Golf social medias. So I have Cobe Life on YouTube, and then I have Cobe Life Golf on Instagram, Cobe Life Golf on Facebook, and Cobe Life Golf on Twitter. You can check all of those out. And now I'm, of course, adding a little bit to the Pro Sports Podcasters as well. So big events like the Players, I'll say something.
Excellent. Look forward to seeing that and learning a thing or two in the coming weeks.
Now, something I think we should get into, because it is you and I talking and we both have a passion for the same sport, is what's going on in the off season in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, the NFL is a game of football, but in the last week or so, there's been a lot of gymnastics going on. A lot of teams jumping and jiving with their salary cap players that getting bumped off the roster, and then some appearing in new places, some restructuring their deals, salaries getting turned into signing bonuses. There's a lot happening in the lead up to free agency, which kicks off in the middle of March. The legal tampering period, as they call it, when players who aren't signed to a contract for 2021 can talk to other teams. But before that, there were 10 teams that did exercise their right to place the franchise tag on players. So the most notable ones were Allen Robinson of the Chicago Bears, the wide receiver, Chris Godwin, the wide receiver of Tampa Bay, and Dak Prescott. Now you might say, hang on, Dak Prescott agreed to a new deal, didn't he? Well, that tag in that instance was merely procedural so that no other team can retire him while that they sort out the final points of their four-year, $160 million contract. So Dak stays in Dallas for another 4 years, and it seems like there's going to be a lot expected of him. Cobe, what do you think of the Dak deal?
Man, did he win that contract. You talk about a win for his agent and for Dak. No trade clause. That's huge.
No trade clause.
No franchise tag clause. That's huge. It's 100 and I think, is it 24 or 26 million guaranteed over the 3 years?
126.
He can leave after three if he thinks he can get a better deal somewhere, with that fourth year available if he feels like he wants to stay. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most impressively one-sided contracts I've ever seen. And I'm seriously surprised, because I didn't expect him to get that kind of money after suffering the injury he did.
Well, Cole, for me, I think it speaks to the couple of things. I guess the market that we're in with quarterbacks, whether we like it or not, you look at the deals that were done for Wentz and Stafford in terms of trades, and Dallas is probably looking at that and thinking, that's probably a bit too rich for our taste to ship a few picks to get a proven starter. Then you think about where Dallas is drafting, and they're probably out of the running for the top 4 to 6 quarterbacks that are going in this class of 2021. And then you, on a more narrow side, you look at the division that they're in. There's only one quarterback who's coming back at the moment from their opponents, and that's Daniel Jones. Philadelphia have Jalen Hurts now, we think. Washington no longer have Alex Smith, no longer have Dwayne Haskins. We don't know who their starting quarterback is. It's not going to be Cam Newton, which we'll get to in a second. So Dallas just decided, okay, let's go with who we know. He knows the offense. He's our guy. And maybe we should have paid him a couple of years ago instead of waiting 2 years. But here we are.
Yeah, they should have paid him earlier. That's a guarantee at this point. But again, hindsight, 2020. But I agree with you. I understand. If you look at the division, having that stability, and let's be honest, Dak is a very good quarterback, should be enough to win that division. It would be shameful if they didn't win the division this year.
And not just that, but Dak was on a record pace last season. He was slinging the rock. He had 9 passing touchdowns before he went down with that injury. And he has that rapport with CeeDee Lamb. he has a rapport with Amari Cooper. Hopefully they can hold on to him. They don't have to let him go via trade or something like that. I know the salary cap is a bit tight now with this deal. But even when he went down, he still ended up with more passing touchdowns than Cam Newton, who had 8 passing touchdowns on the season with New England. Now, Newton has then gone on to sign a new 1-year deal with New England. On the surface, it's worth $14 million. However, when you drill down and look at it a bit closer, it's actually full of incentives, such as playoffs and being healthy, essentially, to play games. So once you sift through all that, it's only really $5.1 million. But that's an improvement on the 1.5 that he was getting the year before.
Yeah, he's not going to see too many of those incentives. I'll say that right now. I'd bet on the fact that the New England Patriots are probably going to draft a quarterback. And I don't know how many games Cam's actually going to start this year when it comes right down to it.
That is a very good point, because they could go and get someone like Mac Jones and
Trey Lance.
Yeah. Yeah, Trey Lance is another one. Maybe even Kellen Mond. We'll find out more about Kellen Mond in time. You'll have to listen to coming episodes of the Pro Sports Podcast just to see what we're talking about. But
that's right.
Cam, you're right. Cam could just be a placeholder or a bridge for the next guy while they see if whoever they draft is ready to be on the center at the NFL level. That's a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, Bill Belichick's a very good judge of quarterbacks. So unless they absolutely flop on a pick, I seriously expect them to draft a quarterback and draft one that will be ready relatively quickly. And when that happens, I mean, let's be honest. Are the Patriots going to win with Cam? They are not. Okay, so you might as well start the building process now. The earlier, the better. And I expect Cam's going to start very few games as a New England Patriot this year.